C-Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 310, Wednesday, September 26th, 2018.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hello, C-Realm Vault subscribers. KMO here with another episode of the C-Realm Vault podcast. About time, right? I'm not going to say much up front. This is not a solo podcast. What you have in this episode is a conversation with my friend Rob. He works over in the complex. It's actually part of the complex where I live, but it's also the place that houses the TV station that I work for and the gym where I work out and occasionally work for. In fact, I'll be working there today. And you've heard him on the show before. He reads a lot of books. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about four books, two that he has read and two that I have read. So the two books that Rob has read, the first is called iGen. That's just four letters, I-G-E-N. That's the generation that follows the millennial generation. The full title of the book is iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us, by Jean Twenge. I think that's how her name is pronounced. Maybe it's Twenge? It's T-W-E-N-G-E. Next, and more substantially, I think, is The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt. I think this is focused more on the millennial generation than iGen, but, generations are fuzzy things. Their borders are not crisp. And then in the second half of the podcast, we are going to talk about comedy. I've read two books on comedy, not recently, but in the past year, and I've spent a fair amount of time with the first of the two, which is The Comic Toolbox, How to Be Funny, Even If You're Not, by John Borhaus. That's a book from 1994. And then a more recent book, this is from 2013, is The Hidden Tools of Comedy, The Serious Business of Being Funny, by Steve Kaplan. I discovered both of these authors on YouTube. There is an excellent, excellent long interview. It's an hour and 20 minutes with Steve Kaplan. The video is just called The Hidden Tools of Writing Comedy, Steve Kaplan, full interview. The channel that put it out is called Film Courage. I highly recommend that you watch that, even if you don't plan to write comedy. It's just a really excellent, in-depth examination of the process of structuring a story. And John Borhaus has got an excellent, it's just a video of him giving a presentation, I think, in Germany. And the video is just called The Comic Toolbox. It is 51 minutes and 46 seconds long. Very worth your time. Again, you don't have to intend to write comedy in order to get something out of this, I think. I don't think it was John Borhaus. I mean, I've listened to and read a lot of things on comedy recently, and one of them said that comedy is almost unique in that what you are striving for is a physiological event, not just a feeling, but an action, an involuntary action from your audience, which is to say, a laugh. And thinking about what causes humans to laugh will be a useful thing to contemplate for anybody who is interested in consciousness. And if you are listening to this podcast, you are interested in consciousness. Anyway, you'll get a taste of each of those books. Just a taste, really. Just a minuscule sampling, really, of what each book has to offer in the coming hour. All right, and with that brief introduction, here's my most recent conversation, recorded conversation anyway, with Rob.
All righty. Back in the fireplace room with Rob.
Hi.
And we've got two seemingly disparate topics to cover here. One is one of the two red books on the table. What is the book?
The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt.
And were you familiar with either of those authors before you picked up that book?
I had never heard of either of them.
Before I turned on the recorder, you were telling me that this is the first book in a very long time that you have purchased, though you read a lot of books.
I read a ton of books, but I hadn't purchased one in a couple of years, probably. I can't even remember.
How did this one come to your attention, and why did you buy it rather than asking the library to get it?
Well, it was too new for my library to have it yet. Mm-hmm. The library in the small village where I live doesn't really get books really quickly. So
not Bellows Falls.
Not Bellows Falls. No, the other one. Bellows Falls does a great job at that. Actually, yes. They always have the newest books that are interesting to me. But now I don't use that library. But anyway, I think I was.
You're on the wrong side of the river now.
Yeah. I think I was looking. I have a subscription to the New Yorker, mm-hmm. and they do book reviews, and they always have one large book review of multi-page reviewing, and then they'll have a short list of like 10 books that are just kind of bring you to your attention. And I think that's where I saw this, but I might be wrong. And the reason I was so interested is because just a few months ago I had read another book that dovetails a bit with this. It's called iGen, mm-hmm. Internet Generation.
You remember the author's name?
What was her name? But it was an excellent book from many perspectives, and it's covering this kind of thing, but it was more of a data-driven examination, and this is more of like a sociological examination, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. So the two kind of go together in an interesting way.
What's your interest in the topic? You're not a parent.
I'm not a parent. I never wanted to be. This is in the vault, right?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Well, when I took this job about a year ago, I inherited an employee, 20 years old, quite a nice guy, smart, does his job. But I noticed that his way of existing, his way of life, was foreign to me. And then I started thinking, he's nice, he's smart, but why?
You know, how is his way of life foreign?
He seems to have no interests other than video games. He doesn't really want to work. That's not his thing. He comes to work, I can trust him and everything, but if he didn't have to, he wouldn't, right?
Right.
He didn't have a driver's license until last year, age 20,
right?
Which is very strange living in a rural area. You need transportation, right?
Right.
I used to use my bicycle before I get my driver's license, and I still do, but still, I had some transportation. I got my license when I was 16. I couldn't wait to get my license.
Don't hit the table.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's much louder on the recording than it is.
But anyway, so, never had a girlfriend, doesn't really socialize, and I thought, that's just very odd. And then I started meeting other younger people around the area that seemed to have some of the same traits, and I thought, this must be something more than just a couple people, to outliers, you know. And
I'm not going to mention his name, but I know the person you're talking about, and I think you're maybe understating some of his condition, like his physical condition.
Yeah, but there are other people working in the same building who who are the same age range, who exhibit the same kinds of traits. They have no real interests. They're working just because their parents told them to get out of the basement and go work. And their parents have to drive them to work, by the way, at age 20, 21, 22. So somehow, I probably
was... I'll cut this. You're talking about...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And there are a couple others. Anyway, so I think probably I was looking at a book review and I saw the name of the other book, iGen, and mm-hmm. I picked that book up and read it, and it explained a lot from a data perspective. It was like, he's not an outlier. These kids I've been meeting are not outliers. This is a generational thing. So that's interesting and scary, because I think in that book it said that 25% of men between 20 and 30, I may be wrong about the exact statistics, but 25% of them are not working by choice. They don't want to work. Now, I guess that would be kind of a dream for some people, but I'd kill myself or something. And what do you do?
Well, I've gone long periods in my life without being employed, and that was before, you know, I was profitably self-employed.
Right.
And I had no trouble filling my time. I mean, I would read, I would exercise and walk, and, you know, I do not need a job to define my identity or fill my time at all. But I know a lot of people do.
For me, I need that structure somehow. for me. It's just my, maybe it's just my personality, but I went a couple of years without working. I had the finances available to me when I didn't have to work, but I had worked solidly since the age of 11 up until that point. So I had earned my sabbatical, so to speak. But after a couple of years, I was pretty bored. Yeah. I needed something to get me going, you know, in the morning. But anyway, so the generational thing is very scary, though, because we have a bunch of people who, I mean, we need people to work. We need people to support our economy and support our social system and our, I mean, who's going to pay our Social Security, right? We're looking at that in the next 20 years or so. Who's going to pay it? Who's going to build the roads? Who's going to be doctors and lawyers and politicians? And, you know, who's going to do these things? I mean, if we have a whole generation of people who are just kind of disinterested. But this book, though, the Coddling of the American Mind, it's looking more at the university students, though. So these people have some motivation. They've actually gotten into college and everything, so they had to do something to get there, right?
Right. Well, these are from high-achieving families, for the most part.
That's true.
They were probably groomed for college and shepherded there by the helicopter moms. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah, this is a very select group of people that this book is talking about. Mm-hmm. But your interest was sparked not by an ideological perspective. It was sparked by seeing a person and then other people, real people in your immediate environment, and just noticing, not without being told or instructed how to view the situation, that they were of a different breed, a very different breed from what you're used to.
Yeah.
And you're from here.
It's
not a regional thing.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and this will, I think, communicate a lot to the listeners. I ask you if you heard Jonathan Haidt's interview on Sam Harris's podcast, and you said, who?
Right. So I knew the name because of the book that I had purchased or was ordering, but I didn't know who the guy was. And I did listen to the podcast over the last hour. Mm-hmm. So I finally did listen to it. And it was interesting.
The first thing you said about it was that the podcast was much more digestible than the book.
Yes.
So not a resounding thumbs up on the book, then.
I hate to put down someone's book because I know it's a lot of work and everything, but I read a lot, as you know, probably in the wintertime I'm reading a book a week, and so I've seen a lot of different styles and stuff, and it was just, I bit through 75 pages of it, and it was difficult. It's another one of these books where I'm taking notes, so that means something, right?
So what have you got in your notes? What's leapt out at you?
Oh, let's see. I got through 3 chapters, I think. All right, well, let's see. So the authors say that they mentioned iGen, right? They identify with that nomenclature for that generation. And they say that things really started changing on campus around 2012, 13, 14, when iGen started going to college. And that's when the mood around campus turned into one that was really not comfortable for a lot of people and really not inclusive and wasn't fostering free speech and the level of personal attacks against people who were trying to have free speech, whatever they were saying, I don't know. The personal attacks just became just vicious and became like gang warfare all of a sudden. And these guys are trying to figure that out, what's going on, right? And there were probably 100 different reasons you could point out of why some of these things are happening. But I think it's important that we understand this word coddling. We've gotten, for somehow, I'm 53, so, and these kids are some of our kids of my generation, right? And it's very, very strange to me that when I grew up, when I was a teenager, I was not coddled. And almost nobody I knew was so-called coddled. I mean, we could go play with our friends at the age of 8 and run around all day on a Saturday, and our parents didn't know where we were.
Right.
And as long as we came back home alive for supper, everything was cool.
Yeah.
If you got a cut on or a bruise, well, whatever, here's a Band-Aid, right? And that's not the way it is now, you know? I used to get on my bicycle at age 12 and disappear for the day and ride 20 miles to a friend's house. And that's not happening anymore. For some reason, our generation, and I'm including you, you're just a few years younger than me, we were not taught to be afraid and coddled, but we've taught our children to be afraid and coddled. We've taught them to fear the world around them and expect to be protected from everything. And I don't know how that happened. It's foreign to me. I was talking to a parent the other day here, and she has a child in high school, and this was in the summertime, and he was on the a sports team at the high school, and she was upset that she had to drive him to sports practice, I can't remember, 3 times a week or every morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. She had to drive him there, and she only lives 5 miles from the high school. I said, well, why doesn't he ride his bicycle? And she looked at me in horror. I said, I used to do that. And it wasn't even a thought for her.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, how did this change like this, you know? So I don't know. But the internet seems to be a big deal in the change in this generation. They've stopped engaging on a personal level. And now they're engaging on this social media level where there's not a lot of diversity sometimes. It gets really tribal online, right? You have your groups, your mm-hmm. pages, you have your whatever, or you're a member of some podcast or something, right? And it's shrinking into gangs, right? And so that's bad enough. That goes against what we want to do from a perspective of diversity and free-flowing ideas and free speech. That goes against that kind of thing. But also, the internet has enabled people to become barbaric with each other in ways they would never do personally.
They wouldn't have done personally until recently. I think a lot of the behavior that Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff are talking about, I've seen the famous videos of students on campuses just screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, at professors or at people they disagree mm-hmm. with or at invited speakers, and behaving in ways that are really quite foreign mm-hmm. to me.
Right.
You know, the whole notion of emotional equilibrium or decorum or, you know, appropriate behavior just seems to be entirely absent.
Mm-hmm.
Like foreign, maybe even, you know, these are considered to be concepts or tools of oppression or something. The idea that you should, you know, keep a lid on your emotions at all, ever.
Right. Do you think that that's fueled by the internet? It starts there. Right? It starts with a student posting a letter from a school president that she doesn't like and she thinks offensive. She posts it online. All of a sudden, she gets 50,000 people literally looking at it and commenting, and the anger starts churning, right? And then it becomes personal after a while, right? So it's connected in my mind. But yeah, you're right. People are acting differently.
Now, I think that there is a difference between people behaving online in a way that they wouldn't in person, and then the dissolving of sort of rules of engagement in terms of civility mm-hmm. in face-to-face conversations within certain circles, particularly on university campuses. Mm-hmm. And the other place where the mentality, I think, that Lukianoff and Haidt are talking about is in tech firms. Mm-hmm. You know, the culture of Silicon Valley seems to be another haven for this sort of mentality and the behavior that it gives rise to. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, being the effect that the internet has had in encouraging us to communicate with people online in a semi-anonymous fashion that we wouldn't do normally, it's connected to this new behavior. But I think that they are different, and that the people being really brutal because they think they're anonymous or because they don't have to deal with the immediate, you know, physiological mm-hmm. feedback from another person right in front of them, I think that's older. Okay. I think that this phenomenon is newer.
Okay. Interesting. I mean, you think back to 1968, right? You and I were not...
I was born in 68, yeah, okay. So my memories of that year are pretty fuzzy.
I don't really
fuzzy.
Remember 68 very well. But, you know, there were a lot of drugs and stuff then, so, you know. But anyway, you remember reading the history and watching news reports and things for what was happening on campus in the 68 especially. And there were wars. There were battles going on, you know.
Yeah.
But so I think to myself, is there a parallel or is it just completely different? They were fighting for, like, ideals and reasons, right? And these kids are fighting because somebody used a word they didn't like.
Well, I think the people that you're talking about would say that they're fighting for ideals as well, ideals of equality and whatnot. But there's a couple different ways to push back against authority, mm-hmm. and they're very, very different from one another. So in the, you know, the 60s, particularly around the Vietnam War and civil rights movement, the students pushing back against authority figures on campus were basically pushing from the left toward the right, because mm-hmm. campus culture at the administrative level and the level of the teachers was pretty stuffy and conservative, mm-hmm. Compared to now, certainly. So pushing back against an authority or a norm is one thing, but there's another way to object to a norm, which is to say, you know, the culture around us says that, you know, people are equal and should be treated equally. We're going to push further in that same direction. We're going to push further in the direction of what, you know, the authority figures say, and then criticize the authority figures for not going far enough in the direction that they say they're going in. And, you know, and if you express one idea and then you don't enact it, you know, you don't live it, then you're a hypocrite. So, you know, you can, and I won't use the Nazi example, but let's say, you know, Stalinist Soviet Union. You could push back against Stalin and say, you know, that Stalin has assumed too much power. He's using violence indiscriminately. He's, you know, he's bad for society. You'd probably get killed if you said that. But, you know, that's the first kind of pushing back. The second kind of pushing back is that, yeah, Stalin, everything he's doing is great. He's not doing it enough. You know, we need more. We need more of, you know, the repression of dissident voices. We need more use of violence. We need to export more people to the gulag. And I think that's more the what we're seeing in, you know, the campus push towards social justice on the left is that they're pushing further in the direction of the mainstream narrative than, you know, the rest of the culture is ready to go. And, you know, because almost nobody is as far left and progressive in a social, you know, in a social context as students at exclusive universities, you know, in New England and on the East Coast and on the West Coast. You know, they are at the bleeding edge, and they say everybody who is not at the bleeding edge with them is a regressive or is, you know, a reactionary or is a white nationalist or a Nazi or whatever. And then even the people right there on the leading edge with them, if you're a whisker behind me in the race, you're a Nazi. You know? But I have not read the book. I did hear the conversation on the Sam Harris podcast. Now, it was interesting to me to hear that you had never even heard the name Sam Harris.
I don't operate in the same areas of the internet that you do.
No.
I don't access podcasts and that kind of thing for the most part. This is this is my internet, the book.
Well, Sam Harris is a he's a polarizing figure. He is much, much hated by the people in, you know, described in this book that
you
just read.
Okay.
Yeah. In listening to him, did he sound like some far right wing extremist or crypto Nazi or anything?
No.
Okay.
He was fairly just objective, I think, so it's hard to tell where he leaned, but and it's only my only exposure to him as well. So
he's hated because he is critical of Islam.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
That's primarily. Also, do you know who Charles Murray is?
No.
Okay. Charles Murray became a much hated figure in the 90s when he co-authored a book called The Bell Curve, talking about human intelligence.
Okay, yeah.
And last year he tried to give a talk at Middlebury College here in Vermont.
Okay, I'm remembering this now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the protesters wouldn't let him speak publicly, so he and the professor, a liberal professor who had invited him, they went to a media lab on campus and they recorded or streamed a conversation between them. And then when they emerged from the building, there was an angry crowd there who physically attacked them.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. That's, you know.
And then the Middlebury administration refused to institute any sort of disciplinary action whatsoever in response to this.
Well, one could say, or I'm saying it, that these students who are claiming that they want diversity and acceptance, they're not. I mean, they're kicking people off campus for having a difference of opinion than them. And that's not a healthy environment. Because I think if my understanding is correct, universities and colleges and higher learning institutions for thousands of years have been about listening to differences of opinion, being challenged intellectually, refining your own way of thinking through the challenges of different ideas. That's what it's supposed to be about. But now it's like, oh, no, you said the wrong word. I hate you now. And, oh, I'm injured. Where's my safe space? I have a microaggression. And it's just gotten to I can't imagine being a university professor now, especially at these elite, especially Northeast universities.
If you're tenured, that's one thing. But imagine being an adjunct professor.
Which is 75% of professors now.
Right.
So you're a temp. You're gone.
You're a temp. get no benefits, you're not paid all that much, you have a serious workload, and if you say the wrong word to the wrong person at the wrong time, you're not only fired, but you're blackballed in academia. You're just done.
Yeah, it's not a pretty place anymore. It's unfortunate.
Is there anything in your notes that we haven't touched on?
Let's see what I got here. Well, I think microaggressions, right? I mentioned it briefly, but we're creating a whole generation of victims. Everything around them is scary, and anything you say or I say is automatically, whatever the intent was, is meant to injure them somehow. And they feel injured by words, and sometimes that's the truth. It depends, you know, why it was said and, you know, that kind of thing. But microaggressions, that's just, it's astounding.
The point that Jonathan Haidt made about that is that microaggressions are defined such that the actual intent of the person who supposedly transgressed is irrelevant.
No, imagine it at all. Not at all. And this is, I noticed this in our criminal justice system as well, especially over the past, well, since I've been paying attention, let's just say 25, 30 years or so, that the results of an action aren't so much what's being you're punished for. It's the results that you are being punished for. It's not the intent. So if you accidentally kill somebody, you can still go to jail for a long time, even though you accidentally killed them, right?
Well, intent comes into it, because that would be manslaughter rather than first-degree murder.
Right, right. But if it's just a complete happenstance, I don't know, I can't explain an example at the moment, but or something much more minor than killing someone. It's just, I don't know. Just something really minor. There's no intent whatsoever. Yes, you have to make amends if you damage some property or hurt somebody or something like that. But you know, we have people sitting in jail for 30 years for nonviolent offense, which they maybe didn't even intend to commit.
Yeah, I think if somebody was injured because you didn't take proper care, then you're guilty of negligence.
Yes.
But you've also, I think, touched on the topic of victimless crimes, and you know, the ones that are paramount in filling our prisons are drug crimes.
Sure.
You know, that's a very different topic, though.
I think we should go into that for hours. You know, we talk about diversity and recognizing other people's rights and that, but it seems like we're definitely becoming more tribal in our society. And the tribalism is very defined now. It's very stark. And it's like gangs bumping up against each other now. And I mean, I could actually see some violence in our country on a large scale, just because of what's happened politically in our country over the past few years. I mean, that's a real possibility. There are a lot of people, especially on one side of the coin, who are very armed and very angry, and they have an intense hatred for the people on the other side, right? And maybe the people on the other side have to have disdain for these folks, but they're not likely to get up, pick up arms and go, you know.
Well, you haven't been following the topic of Antifa then.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting subset of, yeah.
Basically, regardless of political orientation, it is a fantasy of young men the world over that you can make the world a better place by going and beating up people you don't like.
Yes, and we've unfortunately kept that going in our national character over time. Yeah. Yes.
So there are definite left-wing versions of that and right-wing versions of that. And when they're on the streets confronting one another, they're just in heaven.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, think of the high, really. You're there with your posse, you're all dressed in black, you've got masks on, and you are right. You are morally correct in what you're doing, and there's the enemy right there, and just bash his head in. You're going to make the world a better place.
Well, that's what we're seeing. Something I found was interesting is that Haidt was talking about how people on campus, okay, when we're young, we want to fit in somehow. We want to make our own personality known and be known for something. We're a great athlete, or we're the smartest guy in school, or, you know, you're something. You're the best trumpet player or whatever, right? But a lot of people are now gaining prestige by personally attacking other people and being recognized for it.
That's what I was alluding to earlier when I said, you know, if you're not on the bleeding edge with me, you're a Nazi. And the person that I'm most concerned about is the person right next to me on the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
Because if I can criticize them in a way that resonates with the rest of our group, then I get extra points. You know, you don't get any points for criticizing Rush Limbaugh. Not that, you know, any 25-year-old knows who Rush Limbaugh is.
But the internet has made that so much easier. Yeah. So you can attack somebody anonymously, and you can automatically get people around you to say, "Hey, you're right. You're great. You're, you know." And Jonathan Haidt calls it building or gaining prestige, gaining prestige through calling out people. He's calling it a call out culture now. Calling out people for anything.
That's pretty, you know, widespread nomenclature in this conversation. That's not his invention.
Oh, okay.
Now this is great because I think a lot of the people listening are either in your boat and that they don't know much about this stuff except what they've heard me say about it, and it seems like kind of an out of left field thing for me to even be talking about, given the things that I was talking about when they started listening to the podcast.
Right.
Or there are people who are much more steeped in this conversation than I am, and to hear you coming at it from, you know, in the best possible sense, a completely naive place. I mean, your well has not been poisoned, basically. You're not here to grind an ideological axe. You're here to sort of say, look, I read a lot of books. I've been on this earth a while. I've been here long enough and been paying attention long enough to see how things used to work and how they work now and how they're very different from how they used to be.
They are very different.
Yeah.
Man, I still don't understand what happened to my generation. I take responsibility, even though I'm not a parent, okay? I take responsibility for my generation. We messed up.
And I don't think you've met my oldest son. Maybe you've met my younger son. He was here for several weeks over the summer.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I am a parent of two kids, and the oldest boy is, I think the cutoff dates for the millennial generation have changed. It's like when he was born, he was a millennial, but now I think he's iGen.
Okay.
And yeah, he's not in college yet. He's still in high school. And so, you know, millennials now we think of as being basically either almost done with college or into their adult life. You know, they are the young adults of our society. So I think it's probably better to think of him as being iGen. And he is, he's everything that the young man that you were talking about is, except he's, you know, not quite as physically, you know, battered by his lifestyle. But he is so, I mean, he will not walk up to a counter in a store and purchase something.
Really?
He absolutely will not engage in that level of interaction with a stranger.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's about to be, he is now actually, just started a senior in high school.
Wow.
So pretty soon he's going to have to move out into the world and do something that isn't dead familiar. And I worry about him. I mean, that's an understatement to say that I worry about him.
Wow. But how does it happen? How did it happen? You're a reasonably smart guy. You have good intentions and everything. And I mean,
I haven't lived with him in a decade.
Oh, okay. Well, that's maybe part of it. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, on that happy note, let's switch to our second topic. You know, I write a comic strip now. And I think you don't keep up with the comic strip, right?
No. I look at it once in a while when you were posting it. Yeah.
Well, I'm still posting a new one every Sunday.
Okay.
But the first dozen of them, which is, you know, 3 months worth, I wasn't writing them. We had a writer.
Right.
I was bumping heads with the writer. And a lot of times the writer just flaked and didn't get me anything by the time I needed to start drawing. And then I would write a strip. So some of the first dozen strips are completely mine, and the rest are a combination of me, you know, trying to make his ideas fit onto the comic strip format, or me trying to use some portion of what he'd come up with. And it was really frustrating. And then he quit. So I write and draw it myself. But I have been for months now very interested in comedy, not just, you know, something that makes me laugh, but understanding how comedy works. And two of the books that have been the most influential to me are this one, The Comic Toolbox, How to Be Funny Even If You're Not, by John Voorhaus. This book is a classic. This is from 1994.
Okay.
So reading through it, it's full of pop cultural references from the late 80s and early 90s. It's nice. kind of a time capsule to read it, but it's, you know, it makes great points. And this is a seminal book, you know, in the field. So this guy, John Vorhaus, he worked on Married with Children.
Oh, I used to love that show. It was so irreverent.
And as the title implies, it's got a lot of, you know, very specific advice. He doesn't have a general, like, theory of comedy. Mm-hmm. He's got a bunch of different tools, you know, that each lead to a comedic result. Mm-hmm. And he's got some theories about, you know, comic characters and the different types of comic character, you know, comic characters who are like the fish out of water, or the one sane person in a crazy world, or the crazy person, or, you know, the person at war with themselves. You know, there's lots of different archetypes for comic characters, but he doesn't have one sort of formula. Mm-hmm. What he does have is a lot of questions that you ask yourself, very specific questions to get you moving, you know, in the direction of creating comedic characters and comedic scenes. And so I have these flashcards that I have made for myself. And half of the ones that I picked out to bring in here, which they're not in any particular order other than that the ones from this book are up front. And then there's another group from a different book. So, okay, that's where the other book starts. So just a few examples here. Defeat of expectation. So comedy is where you say something to set something up. You have created a picture in somebody's minds, and they have, or in somebody's mind, they have an expectation about what comes next, and you foil that expectation. You say something which, you know, doesn't follow. And one way to describe that is, you know, it's 1-2-4. You were expecting 3 to follow 2. Another way to describe this is tension and release. You set up a situation, you create tension, and then you keep it, or you keep building on it until you get to a point where you release it. And then hopefully the person who is experiencing this tension, the relief is so sudden and so great and so unexpected that it sparks a laugh. Mm-hmm. And that laugh is the release of tension. That's the physiological response mm-hmm. that comedy is aiming
for. I like
for.
That one. That, when I studied music, we studied that.
Yeah?
It's music. You write a symphony, you create tension, you release the tension, or you build and build and build, and you just leave the tension really high at the end on purpose, you know? So it's,
Another element of comedy is clash of context. You bring in elements that don't belong to, and this is, I think, one of the key phrases from this book is, to attack a character's peace. So this author, John Vorhaus, he says, in order to do comedy, you have to be willing to be cruel to imaginary people. That a comedy is basically the world or other characters attacking a character's peace of mind. Mm-hmm. Maybe not intentionally, maybe not directly, but everything, you know, is set up to foil a particular character's desire to have things the way he wants them. And then, you know, because of his background, his primary example is Al Bundy. He says that Al Bundy's his character's comedic perspective is, I'm suffering.
Yeah.
Everything about his life causes him to suffer. So, clash of context. You bring in elements that don't belong. He basically says, one of the questions that he encourages people trying to write comedy to ask themselves is, what would be inappropriate to this situation? So, you're at a funeral. What's appropriate at a funeral? The things that are actually appropriate are very few. You know, dark clothes, solemn behavior, tears, saying nice thing about the person. Anything else, anything outside of that very short list of what's appropriate is funny. Mm-hmm. You know, and the more inappropriate, the bigger the laugh you're going to get. Mm-hmm. Stupid, stubborn, and self-destructive equals funny. So characters who don't know when to quit, characters who go about things in, you know, inappropriate ways, ineffective ways, but who just keep pushing. Mm-hmm. Funny. Four elements of a comic character. One is a strong comic perspective. So you have just a one line to describe how the character thinks they relate to the world. Two is exaggeration. You know, whatever response a character might have to a particular situation or a particular stimuli, just crank it up. Three, flaws. A comic character has to be flawed in some way. But four, they have to have some humanity. They have to have some characteristic about them that makes us care about them. Because if we don't care about them, we don't care what happens to them, we're not invested in their struggle. You know, so if they don't have some redeeming quality, they're not an effective character because we won't identify with them. We won't feel their stress. We won't feel the tension as things get worse for them. Joke alchemy. Recognition plus surprise evokes laughter. So there has to be something about a setup or a situation that, you know, you recognize, you can identify with, you're immediately invested in it. If you have to explain too much in a joke, it's not funny. Mm-hmm. Exaggeration, I already mentioned that. Inappropriate scale or magnitude. What would be inappropriate to the situation? Inappropriate response. Take attitudes and put them in places where they don't belong. So you're expecting, you know, you have a setup, some familiar situation, some familiar stimulus, and, you know, there's an expected response, and you give, you know, an unexpected response. And then striving for the hopelessly unattainable is funny. So all of this is from 1994. A couple generations of working comedy writers came up with this as their Bible.
Wow.
Yeah. So
is the book, is it detailed at this level, or is that what you've drawn from it and detailed it?
It's a mix of both. I mean, Okay. Flip through and look at some of the highlights while I call up this other book, which I only have on Kindle.
The Comic Toolbox. Okay. It is very much a study.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
So let's cut in an example of some comedy here.
Like argument clinic.
Yes.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside.
Don't give me that, you snotty faced heap of parrot dropping!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type makes me puke! You vacuous, toffee nosed, malodorous pervert!
I came in here for an argument!
Oh, I'm sorry, this is abuse.
Stop. It goes on for a while.
Oh, I know it. Yeah. That's funny.
Alrighty. So, Monty Python. Now, Monty Python has a specific kind of humor. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly intellectual sort of humor, like arguing over, you know, what the definition of an argument is.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, negation or automatic gainsaying of what the other person says. It can be. Yeah. That was filmed in front of a live audience, so you have laughter cues. But I noticed that you laughed basically when the audience laughed.
Oh, I did? Okay.
Yeah. And some of the big laugh lines were early on before he finds the right room and he goes into the room and the guy's just hurling abuse at him. He says, I'm here for an argument. He's like, oh, sorry, this is abuse. You laughed there.
That's funny. That's funny.
What's funny about that?
There's a sign in my office. It's what does it say? This is not the customer service department. This is the abuse department. So I was thinking about that for that flash.
Another one where both you and the audience laughed was when John Cleese says, "Okay, time's up," and who's the other one? Not Graham Chapman. Eric Idle? I think it's Eric Idle. Mm-hmm. Says, "Well, that was never 5 minutes." He says, "I'm sorry, I can't argue with you unless you pay." So. You know, he gives him the extra money, and John Cleese, you know, holds his ground. Sorry, I can't argue with you. If you don't pay, I just paid. No, you didn't. So they're back into it. And if I didn't just pay, you wouldn't be arguing. He says, I might be. I might be arguing in my spare time. You laughed at that.
Oh, yeah.
And the audience laughed at that. What's funny about that?
I think I've heard John Cleese say things like that so mm-hmm. often that it's like, oh, there's Cleese again, you know. Mm-hmm. But it is funny. But, you know, one guy's trying to argue. The other one seems like he's not arguing, but he is. That's funny.
So you like Monty Python.
I used to watch it religiously every Sunday night on PBS when I was a kid.
So one of the cards that I was reading out was about comedy needs to include something which is familiar. So if you already like Monty Python, just the sound of the voices, the cadence of the exchanges is all familiar to start with. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of your entry into it. Let's watch. Well, let's run through these real quick. Is there anything in any of these cards which you recognized from that scene, that skit we just listened to?
Okay. Well, that one's there for sure.
1, 2, 4?
Yeah.
So what's an example?
Well, I came in to be for an argument. You abused me. I came in for an argument. You're not arguing. Well, no, I'm not. So his expectation is definitely, or I guess that's this also, a defeat of expectation. Mm-hmm. It's striving for the hopelessly unattainable. Like the guy, he really wants to argue, but he can't seem to know that he is arguing.
Or he has a specific idea of how he wants to argue. He wants to, have a series of propositions or a series of statements which interlock with one another and build on mm-hmm. one another to create support for a particular proposition. And the other guy is not having it. He's like, no, I'm just gonna sit here and reflect back at you everything you say and in little pieces and not build any sort of coherent thought structure. Right. But he doesn't give up. He's still pushing through.
Yeah. Inappropriate response, maybe. He walks into the argument department and it's the abuse department. And then the guy says, I'm sorry, this is the abuse department.
Yeah, he switches from hurling vicious abuse to being really polite. Because. And that's also at work, I think, in the actual argument clinic, mm-hmm. where they're arguing, and then ding, stop, saying, okay, I'm not arguing anymore because, you know, we were doing it in a certain context. That context no longer applies.
Yep.
All right, one more.
Okay.
So you'll have to find it on your phone.
All right.
Help, help, I'm being repressed.
Help, help, I'm being repressed. Okay.
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you look... What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior. Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice.
Now, do you get that, eh? by exploiting the workers, by hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society. If there's ever going to be any progress...
Yeah, there's some lovely filth down here. Oh, how do you do?
How do you do, good lady? I'm Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
I didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship. A self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
Well, that's what it's all about. If only people would...
Please, please, good people. I am in haste. Who lives in that castle?
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What?
I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, that's strange women lying in pop...
Oh, you didn't get to the punchline, though.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's full of punchlines, obviously.
But... Distributed right. Swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony. Be quiet! But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
I mean, if I went round saying I was an emperor just because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they'd put me away.
Shut up! Will you shut up?
Ah, now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Shut up!
Come and see the violence inherent in the system! Help! Help! I'm being repressed! Bloody peasant! Oh, what a giveaway! Do you hear that? Do you hear that, eh? That's what I'm on about. Do you see him repressing me? You saw it, didn't you?
Oh, my God.
Now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Yes. That's so funny. Good stuff.
So, do you see any of these at work there?
Well, I guess what would be inappropriate? Would you necessarily expect a peasant to start spewing out this like communist ideology stuff? You know,
right. A very sophisticated ideology.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
While they're wallowing in the muck.
Yeah.
Listen, lovely filth down here.
Yep. Let's see. Clash for context. Yeah, I mean, this guy sounds like a socialist from 1950s Britain, right?
Right.
He's talking to the king. He's like, well, what? Those things don't go together. but because they do, it's funny. And I think it's probably really funny for Britons because they lived through a lot of those that social movements of the socialism and everything. And they're a much more socialist country 40, 50, 60 years ago than they are now. So I'm sure that older folks are like, oh, yeah.
Also, Arthur is speaking, you know, in this sort of romantic, heroic mold. The Lady of the Lake.
Yeah.
Her arm clad in the shining samite. Thrust Excalibur through the water. And they're like, they describe it in modern language,
yep.
You know. So some woman hurls a sword at you and that makes you the chief executive.
Yeah.
You know, stated in, you know, sophisticated political terms, that's absurd. Mm-hmm. And so there's a clash of context there, mm-hmm. You know, the heroic versus the sort of political theory.
Yeah. Let's see what else we got here. Well, exaggeration, certainly. So they're both sides are exaggerating their situation, right? Yeah.
How about this one?
Stupid, stubborn, and self-destructive. Yeah, I mean, I can see that the king here is, he's not getting ahead in what he wants, right?
Right. He's just trying to get a simple question answered.
Yeah.
Whose castle is that? And he's being drawn into this, you know, this political debate. Yeah. But he's not changing at all. He's not breaking character. He's not adapting his responses to what he's getting from the peasants. He is just pushing on in his stupid same way.
Yeah.
Now, he's not particularly self-destructive here. But yeah, he's not adapting. Okay, so that's, again, Comic Toolkit, How to Be Funny, Even If You're Not, by John Boerhaus. That's what all these cards and concepts come from,
wow.
At least for me. So there's another book that I ordered. It is a more recent book on writing comedy. And it actually references this book.
Mm-hmm.
And in a number of instances, refutes this book.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That's...
So the second book is called The Hidden Tools of Comedy, The Serious Business of Being Funny by Steve Kaplan. And Steve Kaplan, some of what he says agrees with what's here in John Vorhaus, and some of it is completely the reverse. I mean, he completely rejects some of what's in the Comic Toolkit. Basically, he boils all of comedy down to one sentence. Comedy is your average guy or, you know, an unremarkable character struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. And when I first heard that, and I first encountered this line of thought in a YouTube interview with him, which is like a couple hours long, and he keeps coming back to this and reciting it verbatim every time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was skeptical. I'm like, yeah, there's a lot in the John Vorhaus book that doesn't fall into that category. You know, there's a lot of things that I think don't really fall into that category, which are still funny. And he's insistent, nope. But his perspective is that all comedy, all good comedy, all, you know, effective, really working comedy, flows from the characters doing what they would normally do.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, and this is a line that he evokes for, you know, derision time and again. The mentality that he's pushing back against is, wouldn't it be funny if? Mm-hmm. You're not thinking about a character. You're not thinking about their needs, their goals. You're just thinking about a situation that would be funny, and it doesn't really matter, you know, who the characters are. Wouldn't it be funny if such and such happened? And he rejects that. He thinks that is bad comedy writing that leads to just, you know, vacuous comedy or comedy that doesn't make sense, that just doesn't cohere. For him, comedy is, and he, this is important at the outset, he provides an example of a script from a soap opera. And if you think about soap operas, everything in a soap opera is pushed as far away from comedy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is dead serious.
Right.
Everybody is beautiful. Everybody is really skillful, you know, be they a skillful liar or, you know, a skillful manipulator or a charismatic person or, you know, a chief executive of some kind. They're all powerful people, often rich people,
mm-hmm.
And they're beautiful, and everything is played straight. And what he says is that a character who has all of the skills necessary to meet the challenges put before them is a hero.
Okay.
A character who doesn't have the necessary skills to solve those challenges, but persists anyway, is a comedic character.
Okay.
So to make a character more comic, you take away skills, or you take away tools. To mm-hmm. make them more heroic, you give them skills, mm-hmm. you give them tools. So think, you know, James Bond.
Right.
Physically fit, adept in combat, adept with weapons. He's a great driver. He is socially skilled, you know, mm-hmm. to the extreme. He's a seducer. He is, you know, he is cultured. He's a great dresser. He's got great taste, very, very refined in everything. I mean, mm-hmm. across the board, he is skillful. And a lot of times, when you have a character who's like that, it's kind of hard to make them comedic, and you want some comedic beats in your adventure mm-hmm. story. So what do? You give him a sidekick who has no skills,
right.
or, you know, who is seriously lacking in certain skills, and they're the comic sidekick. Another aspect, or another way that Steve Kaplan describes comedy, or, you know, what makes something funny, is that comedy exists in the gap between expectation and reality. And it's the not knowing of the character that creates that gap. So a character is funny because he's attempting to do something, he or she is attempting to win. This is important to Steve Kaplan. You know, their motivation is to win. And their definition of winning will be dependent on who they are as a character. But they are trying to win, and they lack certain tools. They lack certain skills. And one thing that they can lack is knowledge of the situation. And one thing that's almost always funny is they lack the knowledge of what's appropriate to a given situation. So that's where you get squirmy social comedy, you know, where it's really uncomfortable to watch because there is one character who just does not abide by the norms of civilized behavior or honesty or integrity because they just don't know. You know, they don't know that that's appropriate, or they don't know that they really should behave in a certain way, and they don't. You know, they pursue their desire to win in ways that most of us wouldn't because it's inappropriate. So I think the paradigm example of that is the George Costanza character on Seinfeld. I can't stand Seinfeld. I can't watch that show because of that character.
That's interesting.
Yeah, who is an avatar of the writer Larry David.
Really?
Yeah. Larry David, after Seinfeld, went on to do his own show on HBO called Curb Your Enthusiasm? No.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I used to watch it because of George Costanza.
See, I hate that character. I can't stand it. You know, he's lying when he doesn't need to. He's fronting. He is putting on airs when it's not necessary. I mean, he's trying to win the approval of other people, and he just doesn't understand that what he thinks will win their approval is not an effective strategy.
But that's funny.
Yeah,
that's
it funny. Is. It's funny, but it makes me really uncomfortable.
Some of the most memorable Seinfeld skits are with him. The ones that I remember, I know. Oh, man.
So it seems as though you're resonating with Steve Kaplan's notion of comedy now.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, I think that's why I liked Married with Children, you know.
Well, that's John Vorhaus, Married with Children.
Right, but it's the same thing. It's a guy who's not, he's just plodding through life and he's just losing all the time. But he's not the horrible, horrible person, right? So you can identify with him. So, yeah, it's just a normal average guy getting screwed up.
But Al Bundy, I think, respects a lot of the limitations, the psychological and social limitations that most of us respect.
Okay.
That George Costanza does not respect.
No.
So something else that that Steve Kaplan, the author of the second book, says is that comedy comes from characters trying to solve their problems but failing for lack of understanding. So again, the George Costanza character just doesn't understand why certain people are likable, you know, what makes them prestigious. It's not the things he thinks. But he's trying to win according to his understanding and according to his own psychological needs, and he's not quitting.
Right, but my favorite skit is when he realizes that he's not winning because of himself.
Mm-hmm.
He does the opposite. Do you remember that skit? Or you didn't watch it? Right?
I've only seen a handful.
So George is tired of losing, right? He and Jerry are in the diner. That's where a lot of the episodes begin, having breakfast at the diner, right? And he's complaining to Jerry. Jerry, I don't have a job. I can't keep a job. I don't have a girlfriend. I'm living with my parents. What am I doing? He says, you know what, Jerry? I'm just going to, from now on, I'm going to do the opposite of what I think I should do and see what happens. So he says, hey, Jerry, look at that woman over at the bar there. The diner has a coffee bar thing. And, Jerry says something. Well, why don't you go talk to her? He's like, no, she'll never go out with me. Look how she's so beautiful and everything. She'll never go out with me. And he says, you know what? I'm going to do the opposite. He walks up to her. Hi, my name is George Costanza. I'm 45 years old, balding, fat. I live with my parents and I don't have a job. Will you go out with me? Yes.
I think I have seen that one.
That was a great one.
So Steve Kaplan says, the characters need to take actions which are true to themselves and nothing else. They're true to who they are and nothing else, which is, you know, pushback against the wouldn't it be funny if.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this doesn't make sense for our character, but it's kind of funny in the abstract. Let's do it. Let's put our characters in that situation so that it happens. He's like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about writing jokes. Don't worry about coming up with gags. Have a flawed character who needs to do something and they don't have the skills to do it and they're going to try their darndest anyway. And the comedy will just come out of that. He says at one point, I don't have the quote, I don't have it written on a card or anything, but he explicitly rejects the idea that you have to be cruel to imaginary people. That you don't really have to attack the peace of your characters. You don't have to think about that. You just have to have them desire something and not know how to achieve it, but be determined to achieve it, and just keep pushing. Characters who want something are willing to do whatever it takes to get what they want, given the limitations of who they are. So that's his, you know, another observation about comic characters. Struggling against insurmountable odds, without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. I mean, that's the formulation he comes back to again and again, particularly in this this video where I first saw him speaking. So these are the ideas that I have in mind. Now that I'm just writing the comic and I'm not having to sort of accommodate the ideas of the writer, this is how I'm trying to, you know, find the comedy in the situation. Things came to a head with the writer early on when I suggested that we use the formula in this book for creating comic characters, right. And he got offended that I thought I knew something about comedy writing that he, a professional writer of TV, didn't know, okay. And that was the beginning of the end. It got really hard to work with after that.
Yeah.
So let's look back on the Monty Python skits. Mm. We have a character in the argument clinic who wants to have an argument. In a sense, he gets what he wants. I mean, he gets in there, mm-hmm. and he is having an argument.
Yes.
But he also leaves in disgust and goes to complain. So obviously he's not getting what he wanted from this argument. But he keeps pushing anyway. But he doesn't know how to... he doesn't know what to say to John Cleese to get John Cleese to stop just negating everything he says and actually, you know, formulate an argument. You know, a series of propositions which, if true, would guarantee the truth of a conclusion. He can't ever figure that out, but he keeps pushing. And so we get into just the... Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Can be. You know, and then at one point, they're reversed. It's John Cleese has been saying, no, 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 no. And then, you know, there's a switch. And then John Cleese is saying, yes, 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 yes. The other character is saying, no, 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 no. In fact, is saying the exact same thing, the exact words, back to the person he's trying to have an argument with that person was saying just a minute ago.
Right.
But doesn't still, you know, is out of control. He does not control the situation. He's not getting what he wants.
I think he's looking for a different kind of argument. Yeah. That's not an argument. The one that John Cleese is coming back with, that's
right.
Not an argument.
It's not.
Like, hey. I don't care what you say. My ex-wife used to do that one to me, and it made me so crazy that we weren't having a discussion at all. It's like I'm saying something. Nope, sorry. Nope, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. Oh, no, but I mean this. Nope, sorry.
So there's another point of recognition for you.
Yes.
That scene was familiar.
Oh, yes.
And then the other one, the Holy Grail scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Arthur is the comedic character there. The other character, the one who is saying things that clash with the context, you know, of here is the king of the Britons going mm-hmm. across the English countryside, seeking the Grail, looking for the lord of that castle. Mm-hmm. You know, and then here's somebody who sounds like a 20th century leftist.
Yes.
The peasant who sounds like the 20th century leftist, I think, is not a comedic character in the Steve Kaplan sense, in that basically he is getting what he wants. He just wants to tell the king that he's wrong and all the ways in which he's wrong. And he's actually, it's, you know, this is his opportunity to demonstrate to the other peasants around that he's correct.
Right.
See the violence inherent in the system? Yep. He's doing it. He's doing it. And it is Arthur who lacks the knowledge of, you know, how he needs to change his approach to get what he wants. He just keeps pressing with the same approach. Mm-hmm. So it's his not knowing which makes the scene funny. And the clash of context.
Yes. That was a great movie. It had lots of great skits in it. Memorable ones.
You know, we just, of course, it's a podcast, and the audience just heard the audio. Probably they've seen it, but, you know, they may have heard the clip-clop of the horse's hooves at the beginning, but there's a servant behind Arthur as Arthur sort of skips across the countryside who's clapping the coconuts together to make the horse hoof sounds.
Yep. My favorite scene was the knight when he gets into the fight, the sword fight with the knight. Mm-hmm. It's so funny.
Cuts off an arm, then the other arm.
Oh, it's just a flesh wound. Come back here.
All right. So with all this comedy knowledge in mind, back to the coddling of the American mind. No, I'm kidding.
I like this discussion about comedy more than the discussion about the generation coming up now.
Yeah. They are related topics, though, in that the folks, you know, on the social justice left right now, particularly the coddled American mind of the iGen that those authors are describing, comedy is very difficult for them. Mm-hmm. They, you know, they've been encouraged to be traumatized,
right?
Which is sort of the exact opposite of finding the humor in any situation. Yeah. And trying to do stand-up comedy for that audience is very difficult. You know, comedy that is reinforcing the narrative of the dominant society, you know, the dominant structures in society is very difficult. It's much more easy. It is much, there's an easier, more obvious path to ridicule the narrative of the dominant society mm-hmm. than to try to reinforce it. And right now, you know, the ideology of those kids, particularly in the media and in tech circles, you know, which govern social media, that is the dominant ideology.
Right.
So a lot of the irreverent voices now, particularly, you know, on YouTube and on the internet, the irreverent voices pushing back against the self-satisfied worldview of the people at the top are pushing a more right-wing agenda. Mm-hmm. You know, they're referencing more, they're basically mocking the effete liberals, the soy boys, you know, the effeminate man of Silicon Valley.
Right. I think it's funny. I think it's interesting you mentioned it this way, because I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, a childhood friend, and I was telling her that I haven't been able to watch Saturday Night Live for many, many years now.
Mm.
And she says, oh, of course not, because when we were kids, people could make fun of each other a little bit, and it was funny. She said, can you imagine if buckwheat was a skit today on Saturday Night Live? And I said, no, you're right. I can't imagine that now. There were protests outside the NBC headquarters, you know. And she's right. It's, we everything is a slight now, you know. You can't make light of something funny about a certain culture or a certain subset of people. You can't do that anymore, right? Because you're insulting them. You're making them into victims, and you're, you know, yeah.
When you first brought that up, before you get to the buckwheat example, what immediately jumped to mind for me was Garrett Morris.
Yeah.
And Garrett Morris had a character that he played on the news mm-hmm. who was a baseball player, and I think he was a Cuban baseball player who'd been drafted into the major leagues, and then he retired and he became a newscaster. And he was just dumb as a rock, and he didn't know anything about any sport other than baseball. So, you know, another character would try to engage him with talk about football or soccer or anything else. And he couldn't even speak English very well. And all he would say is, baseball been very, very good to me.
I remember that line. I remember. Can you imagine some of the Eddie Murphy skits from the 80s? I mean.
Well, I went back to Garrett Morris, and I wasn't thinking Eddie Murphy. And then, you mentioned Buckwheat. I'm like, oh, yeah, Eddie Murphy.
Someone that like the Velvet Jones, you know, he's the pimp.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the poetry reading pimp?
Buy my book.
There was a fairly recent, I mean, not in the last couple of years, but the last few years, skit on Saturday Night Live where they played with that, where that, you know, you can't say anything that's remotely offensive to black people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a parody of The Walking Dead. Uh-huh. So you've got, representations of the main characters from the TV show, The Walking Dead. And there's a black man who's actually been bitten by a zombie, and he's turning into a zombie.
Uh-huh.
And every time the other characters start to point out some, you know, some piece of evidence that he's becoming a zombie, he turns it around and accuses them of racism.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Literally, you won't regret this. You know, letting me stay in here is really gonna be a hold on. What's wrong? What's going on, y'all? What's up?
You're one of them.
Excuse me? One of them? Oh, my God. No, this is so racist right now.
Well, no, we're not racist. No, it just seemed like you were turning into a zombie.
Oh, okay, I see how it is. So when someone comes from a different cultural background than you, they're automatically a zombie. That's what you're telling me?
No, okay, all right, come on. That's definitely not what I meant. Maggie, why don't you take our new friend to get some water?
Sure. Follow me, Lyle.
Thank you very much.
Hey. You didn't have a bum leg when we first met you, did you, fella?
Okay, you ain't never seen a classic pimp walk before? It's called swag, son. Get a look at it.
Swag. I'm really sorry.
Come with me. We'll get you that water.
Okay.
Well, this is uncomfortable.
Not to sound racist.
Well, I gotta stop you there, buddy. Just starting a sentence with not to sound racist means you're probably about to say something super racist.
Dad! He's eating Maggie!
You get off of her!
Hey. What's up, homie? What's going on?
You're eating our friend.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Would you rather I just eat some fried chicken or some watermelon?
Whoa, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. Usually really cool.
Yeah. Hey, bro, you just do your thing.
All right, that was Rob. And, you know, I ripped the audio from both of those Monty Python segments from YouTube videos. But what you heard in that recording was actually, you know, what came out of the speaker on Rob's phone. And I just went with that rather than cutting in the more high-quality audio so that you could hear our responses in real time to the material. For people who are my age or older, I'm certain that that's not the first time you heard either of those Monty Python bits. If you're younger and somehow are new to Monty Python, well, you know, a wealth of comedy gold awaits you on YouTube. In terms of closing remarks, I'm not going to say much because I'm going to get you another podcast very soon. I will be reading from and summarizing things from the Seed Realm discussion group on MeWe.com, so I would encourage you to check that out and say something there if you would like to have your views represented here on the podcast. And other than that, if there's a topic you'd like me to cover, if there's a topic I've covered recently that you think requires a second pass and some more careful consideration, do be specific. Let me know. You know how to get in touch with me. All right. Thanks so much. I will talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.